hope you're ready to get nerdy with us on today's episode of No Doubter, as we're going to be talking data and unpacking analytics and sabermetrics and its impact on the game of baseball over the last couple of decades. I'm joined here by my co-host this morning, Barrett Bostick. Barrett, boom. Thank you for coming down, man.
Thank you, Travis. You know, I'm Boom Bostick. Trav, do you have a stage name? I mean, in the works? T-Loff? T-Money? I mean,
okay,
what's it going to be? Come on.
You know,
join the club.
Yeah. I mean, it could be multiple things because, to be brutally honest, I've had a number of nicknames through my almost 30 years on this planet.
Do tell.
Yeah, so T-Loff, T-Kobloff. Yeah, I guess you could say T-Money. a few people called me Loafy back in the day. Like, I don't know quite where that came from.
Let's not go with that.
Yeah, that we can just... that one can just be swept under the rug.
Yeah.
That one back.
But, I'm a man of many names myself, but you know, we gotta finalize it. We both gotta have our stage names. Yeah, and for those of y'all listening, y'all can input in too. I mean, you can reach us out to us on Facebook, Instagram, whatever. I mean, this could be kind of like a side mission.
I might have to run a poll for people to vote on what my nickname, my site name should be for this show.
And you gotta be careful with polls, Trav, because you want to give them a finite amount of options, because otherwise you have the Bodie McBoatface, the boat that the British people named the cruise ship. So, but nah, yeah, it could be Boom Bostick and Team Loff or something like that. So.
Yeah, we will let the people decide.
Oh yeah, so but no, man, I'm doing great. I'm excited about this episode for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Man, this is really your specialty, and we've been prepping for it. Mm-hmm. And I know, like, you really kind of our resident data and analytics person, and really like studied and pressed into this part of the game. With how you've built up. Your fandom over the years. So mm-hmm. I'm looking forward certainly to learning a lot from our conversation today and having some good discussion out of it. But first, before we can move on with this episode, as we do with every episode here on No Doubter, it's time for a little pour and score.
That's right, my friend, pour and score, because when you pour, you score, and it doesn't matter what time it is. It's 5 o'clock somewhere, it's 10:45 here, but hey, it's 5 o'clock.
10:45 in the morning right now, but hey.
It's 5 o'clock in England, maybe? I don't know.
5 o'clock somewhere, yeah, probably over in Europe right now.
Yeah, so, you know, why not? It's Saturday, let's do this. So... we have a very special bourbon for you guys. For those of y'all in the audience, you might recognize the name. This is Old Forester, the first bottled bourbon established in 1870, right from the heart of Kentucky. This is a very recognizable brand. This is a 90 proof, and so it is 10:45 in the morning, so we don't want to go too crazy. So I'm going to go ahead and pour us just a very small amount, so don't want to go too crazy. So
yeah, absolutely, this is a nice solid 90 proof. So we kind of keep turning up the ante a little bit here as we continue to make our journey through
the bourbon trail.
Yeah, the bourbon trail that Barrett is leading us along. So just a reminder too, as we're in this segment as well, for all our listeners, is that this is just, we want to unwind responsibly here and mm-hmm. enjoy these drinks responsibly as it is. So yeah, absolutely, remember, know your limits.
Oh yeah, pour and score responsibly, that's the way to do it. So have you ever had this before,
Trav? I believe this will be my first time. You're really leading me on the bourbon trail. It's
oh yeah, for sure. So let's just go ahead. Cheers.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Really goes down smooth. I'm getting kind of like a bit of like a honey kind of aura and an aftertaste to it, which is really nice. Has got kind of that that cinnamon that I feel like you feel it off the tip of your tongue. It kind of hits all of your senses all together. I can definitely feel it's a little bit more intenser on the 90 proof side, but it is smooth. It feels Kentucky.
it's not rough around the edges. I mean, it's a solid 90. Kind of, it's just a smooth ride.
I very much give this a 9 out of 10. I think it's very solid. I've enjoyed it. I will have to take a look for this at the store the next time. Mm-hmm. And man, maybe we can make a trip out to Kentucky someday. Catch like a minor league baseball game up in like Lexington or Louisville or somewhere up there, and then find like a local distillery to like get more educated on the bourbon side.
Yeah, bourbon trail can be dangerous. Yeah, it's on my bucket list though.
Yeah, for sure. And so like with the pour and score segment here just in general, we want to the beverages so you know are not the big name domestic brands. We want to highlight, you know, the hardworking men and women who are behind the making of these beverages, the marketing, the production, the logistics, the whole nine yards of these beverages being what they are. And so, we give a shout out to Old Forester today and what they've created with this excellent beverage.
Great way to start off the day. Small quantities. So
yeah, we're going to jump into it now with the rest of the show and really what we're here to talk about, which is analytics and sabermetrics. And this is a very new aspect to the game of baseball and its very longstanding history that has really emerged over the last couple of decades. And Barrett, I just want you to kind of like lay out the groundwork for it all, like unpack analytics. What is sabermetrics? Just kind of like how all this stuff came about, how it changed the game, the whole nine yards with it. Well, I guess we can even say the whole diamond, so to speak.
Nine yards, diamond, whatever you want to say. Yeah. But when I was plotting out these foundational episodes, I wanted to do a separate one on analytics and sabermetrics because it is such an integral part to the game. This is meant to be kind of an informational episode that we can consistently point people towards for people who are casual fans or skeptical fans and they don't know anything about, you know, slugging or on-base percentages, because a lot of those stats can be pretty daunting and, you know, intimidating. But yeah, it's
an important part of understanding and enjoying the game of baseball as it is today, because this will unpack in a couple of seconds here what analytics and kind of like all the nuances of it did to how a baseball game progresses, like how mm-hmm. series between different teams happen, how the decisions that are ultimately made by different clubs and stuff, and how they approach the game based on what day it is, what series, all those things. Oh, so yeah.
It's an endless, and I'm going to be scratching the surface and I'm going to miss a whole lot and I still have plenty to talk about, but it's so integral to the game that you have to talk about it and you can't brush it to the side. It's so immersed in baseball as of the past 20 years, especially. So I'm going to take us on a chronological journey going kind of all the way up to the present day. So just kicking it off, for the longest time, only simple stats were used to evaluate the value of a player. There weren't any computers back in the day. Obviously, baseball has been around since the late 1800s. But even back then, you know, they wanted to put a value on a player to some degree. It's not just all, how he looks like. So the most common stats were batting average. Every time you go up to the plate, X amount of percent, this is the percentage that you get a hit. Not on base, but a hit. And home runs, you just total up the home runs and RBIs. How many runs do you bat in? Very, very simple. Scouts have been around since the beginning of time or beginning of the sport. And their goal is to try to find these special players. But on top of these simple stats, because again, you're just jotting stuff down, pen and paper, pencil, whatever. They, you know, put value on a player mostly based on not objectivity, but their subjectivity in terms of how they looked, their physical appearance. How does this guy look when he swings? How does this guy look when he pitches? Oh, this guy's tall. He's strong. He's fast. It's stuff that's pretty plain to see. It's not like...
And it's subjective to a lot of biases, yes. It seems like, as well.
And inconsistent, because it's not efficient. Yeah. But regardless, that was how players were valued. And thus, that was how the game progressed. I mean, Babe Ruth came around and he brought in a lot of people to the stands, and obviously he's a legend, and the long ball was cherished, and batting average for people like Ty Cobb and Ted Williams, and I'm not saying it's bad. It's a good start, but as I will unpack, it has a lot of inefficiencies. But just moving on, so... Again, they weren't objectified. It was just more based on the perception of scouts. So this was going on for several decades. But the first prominent person to kind of want to break the trend, just say, hey, maybe there's a different way we can look at players. Maybe there's something different. You know, someone who just kind of wanted to rock the boat a little bit. This person's name was Branch Rickey. Branch Rickey is a very important figure, in baseball history. He was the general manager for the Brooklyn Dodgers. That's right. A lot of people know the Los Angeles Dodgers, but they used to be in Brooklyn, New York. And in the 40s and 50s, Branch Rickey was the general manager. And on a side note, he was the person who was mainly responsible for acquiring Jackie Robinson and orchestrating him breaking the color barrier. So, very, very important figure. But putting that aside, that is a very important reason why he's important. But putting that to the side, on top of that, he wanted to innovate the team as a general manager. All these batting averages and home runs and RBIs, it just seemed too limiting. And Branch Rickey wanted to come around and he said, you know, I want this team to be great. He orchestrated the first spring training facility, a way for players to ramp up into shape prior to the start of the season. He encouraged the use of commonplace tools such as batting cages, pitching machines, batting helmets. We're not even going to go there, but for the longest time, players didn't wear helmets while they went up to bat. You can imagine that did not go well. But that's a completely separate note. But the bottom line is Branch Rickey pioneered the use of statistical analysis. He hired a full-time analyst onto a baseball team named Alan Roth in 1947. Think about that. Side note, this is the year that Jackie Robinson made his debut, but a full-time analyst in 1947, this wasn't even on anybody's mind at the time. This was so ahead of his time, groundbreaking. It's just like, what? Analyst? Like, what the heck is that? But he wanted a full-time analyst so that they could further evaluate players and see their true value and implement them into the roster accordingly. After viewing Roth's evidence, he promoted the idea that on-base percentage, the amount of percent that a batter gets up to bat and gets on base by either a hit or a walk, he was blasphemous for saying that that's actually more important than batting average. A very novel idea at the time. And this school of thought wasn't accepted throughout the rest of the baseball community at the time. It was just, for whatever reason, that's just too crazy. Baseball, from the beginning of time up until wait until now, it's been very slow to change. So when someone rocks the boat like this in the 1947, it's change. It's a different way of viewing the game, and everyone else is just like, whatever, man. But Branch Rickey implemented that into his team. Won a couple of World Series, at least one with Jackie Robinson. But this was just like a spark, but never really caught on. But we have to talk about Branch Rickey because he, like I said, was ahead of his time. He was on the
pioneer. Like he was the guy who ultimately you can trace it back and the roots of it all started with him. He doesn't come around. Like he doesn't ever start it. Like at least like it does the idea of bringing more objective analytics into the game does not come around in 1947. It has to come with somebody else.
Oh yeah, it does. But you know, he was on to something, as I will point out. And we've got to fast forward 3 decades later to the most important figure we will talk about throughout this entire episode, by the an ordinary man by the name of Billy James. He defined a new notion of viewing the game known as sabermetrics. This is just a normal guy. He loved baseball, and he was so frustrated at the inefficiencies of baseball. Baseball is a very predictable game in a lot of respects. Person goes up, they hit the ball somewhere, and they're either going to get out or get a single or a double. It's very, I mean, you could listen to baseball on the radio and they'll just talk about it and you can know exactly what's going on.
You can argue that there's overthinking when you get more into like the deeper analytical side, but then there's also overthinking on the like analytics agnostic side too of baseball, of just the little idiosyncrasies, and it turns into like this mental chess match of, oh, do we do this? Do we not? Like going off your instincts of every little tick or thing kind of, you see this is off with it. And again, it can make a game, as we talked about with the issues of baseball, just way longer than it needs to be because of that.
Exactly. But Billy James, this man is known as the father of sabermetrics. Again, Branch Rickey kind of pioneered the idea of emphasizing on-base percentage, which we will talk about in just a second. Again, he was on to something there. But Billy James really, he kind of, you know, made it tangible. As I was saying, he's the father of sabermetrics. Sabermetrics, we've been dropping this word a bunch of times in this podcast, and you're like, what the heck is sabermetrics? Sabermetrics is the search for objective knowledge about baseball, especially regarding stats that measure in-game activity that are much more advanced than simply batting average. Again, Billy James loved baseball, was on a quest to make evaluating players more efficient. He, on his own accord, started writing abstracts. So it's like the Billy James Abstract, a self-published book that he wrote his first one in 1977, 3 decades after Branch Rickey had a full-time analyst on his team. These books slowly but surely started gaining followings of diehard baseball nerds who started hopping on to the same idea. Every couple of years, Billy James would be publishing these abstracts, you know, with these crazy ideas on how to view a game much more sophisticated than batting average, home runs, and RBIs. And more people started to catch on. It was a very grassroots movement. These books offer new and monumental ways of turning the art of baseball into a science. It's not, oh, how does this guy look? Oh, this guy looks good. He runs fast. It's turning it into a science.
Yeah.
Into something that you can put numbers to. It's analyzing the game in an effort to create maximum results from a player and a team's potential. Just very fascinating way of viewing the game. In 1984, he wrote another abstract like he had all the way up from 77 to 1984, venting about his frustration that stats on players were not available to the public for people like him to use to evaluate players. They just weren't available. You know, there wasn't some website you can go. The baseball reference wasn't around. And he was frustrated because he's like, I can take all these stats and I can evaluate a player, but I can't get it. So this led Billy James to create a group called Project Scoresheet, a nonprofit group of fans that gathered stats themselves. They began volunteer basis on their own accord, so that way they can start evaluating players and their trends from when they started. So this is like in the 80s. So, okay, we don't have anything before then, but just starting now, we're going to gather stats and then use what little we have to evaluate the players and develop our stats, which we'll talk about later. Everything up before 84, it wasn't publicly available, and it would be such a pain to be able to get that, because the more numbers you have, the more data you have, the better your sabermetrics and analytics. So they started this group. They would gather these stats and compile them. And these were much more sophisticated stats than batting average, hits, home runs, etc. They included where someone hit the ball. They divided the field of play into 26 areas and included what type of hit was it? Where in the strike zone a player hit that ball? What was the pitch count when he hit that ball? How fast was the pitch? They divided the strike zone into nine areas. And you can start to get the point here. They're taking a simple game and they are just minuting it to the littlest, every little detail. That was what they were doing. And the more stats they created, the more they were able to defer away from the common knowledge of evaluating players. And in the following years, Billy James used these stats that were gathered by these volunteers to create books that included the stats, further demonstrating his new way of looking at the game. The organization eventually disbanded because, you know, it's volunteers, it's hard to keep track of everyone, but it was a very diehard grassroots effort. It's very impressive. It disbanded Project Scoresheet, but some of its members went on to create for-profit companies that collected these stats. The most successful one of these companies was Stats Inc., which Bill James himself joined. And Stats Inc. was eventually acquired by Fox Sports. A lot of people know what Fox Sports is, a major brand. In 2001, Fox Sports acquired Stats Inc., signaling the nationwide acceptance of these valuable stats. So as you can see, it's just several years of kind of crescendoing to a point where in 2001, and a lot of things happened in 2001, as we'll talk about in a sec, stats becoming mainstream. So again, it's all working its way up to the first ever just implementation of all this effort from Branch Rickey to Bill James. I keep calling him Billy James for some reason, but Bill James, it's all going to crescendo to a magical moment where people are going to be, teams are going to be able to use these stats for their great advantage. And all the way up until 2001, James's work was largely ignored by first. Until a few years later, there was a team by the name of the Oakland A's. They were able to fully put it into practice that very same year, 2001, that Fox Sports acquired Stats Inc. And this is the era of Moneyball. That's right. There's the movie Moneyball with Brad Pitt and Jonah Hill. There's a book that I highly suggest, ladies and gentlemen, that you read. It is a fantastic book. It's written by the same guy who wrote The Big Short. A very good author. But this is really the first time that a team can use all these decades of hard work, a different way of viewing the game, to their advantage, regardless of how much money they had. So again, this is only 20 years ago, but this is the start of a new era in baseball. Baseball's gone through a lot of eras, but this is the new era. So I'm going to set the scene. In 2001, under the leadership of general manager Billy Bean. What a great name. Billy Beane was the general manager of the Oakland A's. He had an assistant general manager who was another disciple of the Jamesian school of thought, Paul De Podesta. They were dead last in the league in the previous season, the 2001 season. Their team was pitiful. They didn't have a lot of money. Oakland, I mean, come on. They did not have a lot to work with.
Oakland, I feel like historically has been in the Bay Area there. It has kind of been overshadowed by the Giants.
Across the Bay. Yep. Poor Oakland. And they got to play in that Coliseum too, which is, it's an ugly stadium.
Yeah. And you know, the Coliseum, this is a complete aside, but the Coliseum used to be beautiful back in the day. Like, I've seen the pictures before, before the Raiders started playing there. And like, it really was a baseball focused facility. And like, you see, like there wasn't the upper deck and the outfield out there. It's just, it was more looked like a traditional baseball stadium before they enclosed it in to give it more of like the shared football baseball atmosphere. And like, you'd look kind of out into the hills of the East Bay, out there. And it was just a beautiful scenery, but then, yeah, it just kind of became this monstrosity that was known for, being shared between the home of the Raiders and the A's. And
yeah, it's just, you watch a game on TV and you're just like, God, this is just so ugly. It's like Tropicana feel. But so the A's, they are one of these teams who, much more back then, but even a little bit to this day, they don't have a lot going for them. Nobody wants to play for Oakland. They want to play for LA, San Francisco, and all those big teams. But in 2001, this manifested in them not having a lot of money. If you have a lot of money, you can buy good talent. Even using the old school metrics, you can buy the biggest and the strongest and the fastest guys available, and you're left with the crumbs when you're in the small town teams. But you can take advantage of being onto something that no one else is on. And before I get into the specifics of how the Oakland A's were able to utilize Moneyball to overperform, I'll go ahead and just show you the result of that fateful offseason in 2001. They had high draft picks because, again, they were dead last, and they were able to get players that no one else thought were special. And the very next year, in the 2002 season, this team won 103 games, including 20 games in a row. The first time a team had won that many games in a row in over 102 years. They made the playoffs with a payroll three times less than the Yankees. To put that in perspective, the payroll for the Oakland A's was $39 million, and the Yankees was $125 million. Both teams made the playoffs. So again, you have three times less money than the Yankees, and yet you still made the playoffs. Both teams were eliminated in the first round. The Oakland A's made playoffs for three straight years with, again, laughably low amounts of money. How were they able to do that? There is a huge discrepancy. Overperforming, outperforming. Well, I'm going to start getting into that. If you don't want to read the book Moneyball or listen to the audiobook, at least watch the movie. I mean, the movie's, it's got Brad Pitt, Jonah Hill, and the late, great Philip Seymour Hoffman. It's a fantastic movie, nominated for a bunch of Oscars. But to kind of get more into the specifics, I've been kind of leading this all up, and it's been, you know, leading it up all the way to this point. But before I get into the specifics, I'm just going to open with a quote from the movie. In the movie, there's a character by the name of Peter Brand, who is a fictional aggregate character. He's the money guy. He's meant to be Paul De Podesta, the assistant GM. But in the movie, this is a quote from the movie, not the book. This is going to kind of kick us off into getting into more of the specifics. Peter Brand, the character in the movie, says, "People who run ball clubs, they think in terms of buying players. And your goal shouldn't be to buy players. Your goal should be to buy wins. And in order to buy wins, you need to buy runs. This is a pretty crazy quote. I mean, very, very, just right off the bat, you're going from players to wins to runs. I mean, wow, that's different. You're not buying a person. You're buying the potential that a person can bring to a team, manifesting in runs. And this begs the question, how do you get runs? The simplest and most efficient way to get runs is to avoid getting out when you go up to bat. That is the goal. You don't want to strike out. You don't want to get to three outs in any given inning when one gets up to the plate. And the best way to do that is get on base. So this goes all the way back to Branch Rickey, again, who was on to something. On base percentage, the amount of times the percentage of the person gets on base, avoids getting an out. This manifested in the Bill James abstracts, which now comes into Moneyball. So a player can get on base in one of two ways. The most obvious way is to get a hit. Even people back in the day knew about this. But another way is to get a walk. I mean, yeah, it's not as exciting, but you technically get on base. And this whole idea was to overemphasize, put a greater emphasis on being able to draw walks, not just be free swinging and strike out, trying to get a hit, swing for the fences. This whole way of thinking is fundamentally different to a player's plate approach. Instead of trying so desperately to get a hit, you're like, hey, if I can draw a walk, it's all good because I'm getting on base. It's a new goal. The goal's not to get a hit or a home run. It's to get on base by any means necessary. Billy Beane and Paul A. Podesta saw the value in a player being able to draw walks when no one else did. Drawing a walk means getting on base, which means you have a better chance at contributing to another run. And again, going back to the quote, it's buying runs. Your ability to draw walks increases your ability to produce runs. And they were forced, because they didn't have a lot of money, to direct their attention to players whose qualities were undervalued because they could not afford players who were overvalued. And this goes to everything from pitchers to batters. For batters, there was a high demand for home run hitters. This is roughly around the time where we had the Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa home run battle. And people loved the long ball.
You know? Yeah, you had Mark McGwire and Jose Canseco, the Bash Brothers.
Oh, yeah, the Bash Brothers. People loved, and funny enough, they were on the A's too.
Yeah, and man, they were roided out of their minds.
Oh, like, yeah.
They were juiced. But I mean, it was a show at that time. Like, people tuned in for it. People showed up to the games. Like, yeah.
Oh, yeah, long ball for sure. But everybody was going after the, you know, just the long ball types, the big, strong home run hitter, Barry Bond types. But they were forced to put their focus on people who could get on base. It's not about hits, home runs, net only. I'm not saying those are bad things. Those are good things, but getting on base. For pitchers, there is a high demand for fastball throwers, pitchers who looked good while they threw. The Nolan Ryans of the world. Now, Nolan Ryan, very great guy. If you can afford him, man, get him. But if all the people who can throw heaters are gone, I mean, and you try to get people who can throw fastballs, you know, low 90s, upper 80s, I mean, there's a whole lot of those, but not a lot of people like Nolan Ryan back in the day. So, but there was not a high demand for pitchers who were able to get outs no matter what it took or how silly they looked while throwing pitches. Again, you might think it doesn't matter what they look like while they're throwing. They were able to get a player who threw sidearm. Sidearm pitching? Psh, that's ridiculous. At the time, people were like, this look, I mean, this guy looks ridiculous. Throwing like under, he's starting low and then sidearming it.
Yeah. Into,
like,
what? And now we look at guys, and, you know, like just a few years ago. And then now we look at guys like just a few years ago, like Chris Sale, who are at the top of their game. Like these big, tall, lanky dudes, you know, sometimes kind of look awkward. Like, hey, how on earth are these guys controlling their pitching and their arsenal of pitches? But they, you know, some innings it's like, hey, they're right on the money. They're getting guys out, boom, 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 boom. And then other innings, it's like they're very much, the pitch counts are extended, getting a lot of balls teed off or foul, just kind of drawn out. But like they manage the when they're up on the mound so well. And I think that you can very much attribute that to analytics and sabermetrics and how we look at that in the games today.
You absolutely can. Because again, if you're a pitcher, you don't want people, it's the flip side. You don't want the opposing team to get runs. So that means getting them out by any means necessary, not just strikeouts, but forcing ground outs and pop outs, your ability to prevent extra base hits, not giving up homers. It's all linked to the types of pitches you throw. And heaters are great, but what about pitchers like Zach Greinke, who grow max low 90s, but they're the junk ball pitchers of the world, and their stuff is just junky, and it's just nasty, and it's curves and knuckle curves and sliders, and it's so annoying because players love hitting off a fastball if they know it's coming, but if you're painting the corners with all these junk 80, 70 mile an hour balls, I mean,
yeah, you're relying on a lot of framing from your catcher to like make it look like it's
There is value in that.
Yeah, and I say as a fan, too, from a fan's perspective, that I've kind of come to, if there's anything while I'm watching a game that I focus, especially on TV, with the way, you know, like the cameras are set up and just kind of that sort of atmosphere of watching it from your couch and how you see the game that way, that pitching becomes one of the most fascinating things to watch because it's like you see how it all unfolds from on the mound, the delivery, the relationship with the pitcher and the catcher, how the umpire, what their strike zone looks like how that affects the rest of the game unfolding. And yeah, to me, it's really enjoyable to see a pitcher who has a arsenal of different types of pitches. So, you know, like with kind of within like the modern day analytics, you'll hear the announcers talk about like, hey, this is what, you know, kind of their portfolio looks like of pitches and like what we could come to expect throughout the game. And, you know, a lot of times it leads to a lot of innings where it's like, yeah, they have multiple guys that they have to go through, you know, to maximize their, maximize the pitch count. Like they have to, they have to work through ultimately getting these guys to swing at and foul on balls so that way to keep them into it, but then ultimately getting these guys out. And I think I think it's one of the more fun parts of the game to watch. I mean, yeah, the getting runs, all that from the offensive perspective, obviously, yeah, getting runs, home runs, on base, all that stuff is fun to watch. But when we're coming like the defensive perspective and stuff too, like when your team is on the mound, they're like seeing a pitcher and how they navigate it all it's one of the more fascinating things for me.
Oh yeah. I love it when pitchers can paint the corners, but it's, again, it's not just heaters. It's expanding the paradigm, just the school of thought of how to evaluate a player. And the Oakland A's were onto something because they actually adopted. Bill James was so desperate for teams to adopt all of his hard work that he had acquired on his own time and his own money for free. He was like, he's so desperate. It's like, can a team just implement these ideas? And the Oakland A's blew the gates open and they finally did it. I mean, just kind of the fast forward, I was watching the Astros play the Angels the other night, and the Angels, their pitcher was a pitcher by the name of Cobb. And when I was watching the game, they were analyzing this pitcher's types of pitches. He literally does not throw fastballs. Literally. 100% of the pitches he throws are not fastballs, which that's crazy to me. Like, you throw a fastball 0% of the time. All he throws are sliders and curves and changeups. That's it. And that is the manifestation of this school of thought. He's a starting pitcher who does not throw fastballs, and yet he can still put good outings. The Astros destroyed him two nights ago, but my assumption is that if his pitches were actually working, he would be effective. He wouldn't be a starting pitcher on a roster at the major league level if he wasn't effective. So that's just a little glimpse of this whole movement, which it's a different way to look, out of necessity. This whole movement is based out of necessities. The Oakland A's, they had a necessity to do this. They had no choice but to grab these players that people were just glossing over. This way of thinking forces team management to look at players through their appropriate context. How can they benefit the team as a whole? In baseball, you can't just buy yourself a Pat Mahomes or bank on getting someone like Tom Brady and you're set. Baseball is a team sport. That's why the Angels have the best player in baseball, Mike Trout, and they still can't win because one person can't win World Series. Yeah. So that is the whole point. And teams, they saw what the A's were doing, and they took on to it. At first, the A's were novel. They were able to, you know, just step outside of the crowd. They were able to stand out because they were one of the only teams doing this. But over the years, teams were starting to catch on. Nowadays, teams have full-time analytic teams. Not just one person, but a team of stats players. And this, the progression in technology has made it even easier to look at players in this way. And the teams have taken after the A's and are now utilizing players, their extensive catalog of stats, to make more efficient picks instead of paying crazy amounts of money for players that fit the old school mentality. And I mean, some teams still do. Again, if you're the Yankees or the Dodgers and you can afford to get just a crazy good person and just throw a bunch of money at them, you can do that, and sometimes it works. But more and more teams are being more efficient with their money, expanding their limits, getting players from overseas, and they have a huge foothold in places like the Dominican Republic and Cuba. I mean, you can get people from all over the world, Japan, you know. The old school mentality is what led to contracts that the Angels made with Albert Pujols. Albert Pujols is entering into the 10th year of a horrible contract in which he'll make $30 million this year of a $240 million total contract value. And the Angels paid a bunch of money for this player because he's Albert Pujols. He hits home runs. He is now currently fifth on the all-time home run leaderboard. And again, that's great. I mean, if we were still stuck in the old mentality, we would have wanted to get the people who can hit bombs. But that investment is not panning out. Albert Pujols can't run. He did steal base. He did steal third a couple days ago, which was hilarious and awesome to watch. But most of the time, he can't run. Yeah, he can hit bombs. It's either bomb or bust for Albert Pujols. But contracts like that are becoming less and less to an extent. And if it is breaking the bank, it's on young people. It's not people who are approaching their 30s and, oh, let's put them on a 10-year contract because they can hit bombs. Yeah. That ain't happening, my friend. Other teams like the Tampa Bay Rays. The Tampa Bay Rays, I love the Tampa Bay Rays. They have a low payroll, and they outperform like crazy. They use a concept called arbitrage, the simultaneous buying and selling of commodities. And in this case, it's players using Wall Street tactics to buy low, sell high. Again, it's all from necessity. The Rays have to compete with the Yankees and the Red Sox in the AL East. The Yankees and the Red Sox are two of the most coveted franchises in baseball history. They have loads of cash.
And the Rays, kind of like the A's, they have to implement these tactics. And it's just a way for teams to try to get an edge if they can out-analyze or out-sabermetric the other team. The Rays, again, another book I'll recommend is The Extra 2%. If you read Moneyball and you love it, if you think it's great, read The Extra 2%. The Extra 2% is a book on the Tampa Bay Rays and how they are able to consistently gain an edge over the Yankees and Red Sox. Very fascinating. But the Rays are one of the first teams to utilize modern technology such as PitchFX. PitchFX is monitoring a pitch's speed and trajectory using three permanently mounted cameras to value pitchers by analyzing the quality of their pitches, how they bend, their spin rate. Again, we're just scratching the surface on this, but, you know, it's just, there's the whole point of this episode is like, there's so many ways to evaluate every single thing that a player does. And it really is fascinating. You have people who have nothing to do with baseball working for baseball teams. They have degrees in statistics. And, you know, they're not sports experts, but they provide value to a team. Going back, the spin rate affects the movement of a ball, making it harder for batters to get a hit. So it's not how fast is the pitch, what is the spin rate? You know, where is the ball when it leaves the pitcher's hand versus where it actually is when the catcher catches it? So, this all brings us to kind of the meat and the nitty-gritty of these stats. Batting average, home run, RBIs, we've talked about that a lot. But now we're going to define stats. And this is really what's going to be the informational part of this episode, kind of a reference that we will point our listeners to. We're going to talk about on-base percentage, what is it actually, and slugging and all that. And before we go into that, Trav, these stats, I mean, what has been your, have you been familiar with these to a degree or to a small degree before this point?
Such as on-base percentage,
on OPS.
I'm looking through these and on-base percentage, slugging percentage, OPS, ERA, those kind of like, I feel like I've got a base foundation for each.
Yeah. And really, this is just a good assignment for, you know, the casual fans or the skeptics to just get a better understanding of the common way to evaluate a player. OBP, on base percentage, is how frequently a batter reaches base per plate appearance. This includes hits, walks, and hits by pitches. So Craig Biggio, he's, I think, either first or second and hit by pitch. He got on base. He's just tightened the zone there. Slugging percentage is the total number of bases a player records per bat. This only deals with hits and doesn't include walks or hits by pitches. So it's a different way. It's a different metric. So it's getting on base versus getting on base by hits. And then this leads into on base plus slugging, OPS. When I was at Globe Life Field for a game this year, they'll on the scoreboard, they'll list all the players, and normally they'll list their batting averages. But Globe Life Field, they were listing their OPS. OPS is now widely accepted as a more superior stat for a player. OPS. And again, this is simply taking the on-base percentage and slugging and adding them up. An OPS of, let's say, around 900 makes a player superior. Just to get a ballpark, if you can get 800, 900, over 1,000, you're invaluable. It's another way to value a player that extends beyond their ability to get hits. Walks, getting on base is very is very important. Then that brings us to arguably the most important stat that we'll talk about. Wins above replacement. WAR. It's a pretty cool acronym. This measures a player's value in all facets of the game by deciphering how many wins he's worth, as opposed to a replacement level player at the same position from the minor leagues. So it's wins above replacement, being replaced by a minor league player. So, oh man, the math equation on this is crazy. It takes the person's batting runs, base running runs, fielding runs, positional adjustment, league adjustment, replacement runs, and then divides all of that by runs per win that the team has. I don't even want to go any further than that, but you get the idea. They've taken math and all these stats, and they are able to project that a player is worth 3 runs or 3.2 runs. But here's the thing. It is possible to have a negative WAR. It is possible to be worse. If you have a negative WAR, that means you need to be replaced. So that's the catch 22 of that. Now I'll list a few pitching stats and then I'll just kind of wrap up, you know, the spiel on stats. Pitching stats, you've got ERA, earned run average, every time you go up and have an outing, you give up X amount of runs. The lower your ERA, the better you are as a pitcher. But then there's another great stat called WHIP. WHIP is walks plus hits per inning pitched. In baseball statistics, walks plus hits per inning pitched is a sabermetric measurement of the number of base runners a pitcher has allowed per inning pitched. It's calculated by adding the number of walks and hits allowed and dividing it by the sum of the number of innings pitched. And a great WHIP is considered to be as close to one greater. Pitching is the adverse of batting stats, where the lower the numbers are, the better.
Yeah.
Like in golf, the higher they are, the worse they are. But WHIP especially was birthed out of the sabermetric era. It was just a way to value a pitcher's ability, not just in terms of their total strikeouts or not just ERA, but are you preventing people from getting on base? Offense, you want to get on base. Pitching, you want to prevent them from getting on base. Just wrapping, we just scratched the teams. This is the way the game's played. And you have cameras, you have iPads, you have technology, you have extensive databases. This is integral to the production out of that. We're wrapping up. What are your general thoughts, Trav, on just the way this is implemented in baseball?
Yeah, you say we've just scratched the surface, but man, over like the past 45 minutes, I feel like I've learned a ton from all this as it is. Yeah, so because I'm somebody who has very, as we've talked about before, I'm more of like, I feel like almost like the baseball culture kind of guy out of the two of us here on set. And so I have much looser understanding of analytics, but you really paint the general gist of it. And that's given me a much more clearer picture to understand it all, especially like in implementation. And then when I'm watching the game, like unpacking it, and then like, you know, if I'm to look at how these stats unfold, I'm looking at like the stat tracker on ESPN. So I think, yeah, I see one of the big thoughts that came across my mind from a few minutes ago was the sabermetrics almost seems like it's like a catch 22, and the analytics progression of baseball over the past 2 or 3 decades seems like a catch 22 in a sense. You know, baseball being America's greatest pastime, the whole idea behind that was that like baseball was a layman's sport. It is like kind of, it's got that sort
of, it's more for the common people.
Yeah. It's more for the common people. Yeah. In an odd sense, like almost like a paradoxical sense, like it's like the sport for the common people, but for so long, and still is to an extent, but you know, for like so long, the idea was, is like, you know, it was a, for the common people with aspirations of like, you know, you can get success ultimately through how much money you have and like the ability to be able to buy the talent that it is. You could, some might argue is like saying, hey, introduction of analytics and data and kind of really that focus within the game, it has been like a reversal of that, because it is made it to where like, yeah, you can't, but just buying talents does not get you guaranteed success like it used to. And it makes for more of like, hey, these lesser big name kind of guys can be the guys that, you know, are very much the ones who are getting runs on the board, and at the end of the day, getting the W for you, and keeping you in it and keeping your aspirations for the pennant race, and then to ultimately get to the World Series alive. It's almost like, yeah, it's this weird kind of paradox and kind of like catch 22 of like, hey, we can complain about the progression of analytics and everything in the modern game of baseball, and how maybe it does, it is kind of ruined some sort of like baseball purism. But in a sense, like it makes, if you've got more, I feel like, you know, if you've got more teams, you've got less like a disparity between like the really great teams and then like the really bad teams. I feel like that's something to keep fans interested throughout the entire season of, hey, you know, your division, you've got three or four different teams that are competing ultimately for places in the postseason. I mean, that just makes it better. It's going to keep you as a fan interested in your local team or your favorite team of choice, get an eye on the schedule through the rest of the year as those series come along that are going to ultimately set the standings for your division and placement going into the pennant race. I see it's almost like, yeah, it's this paradoxical catch 22, you could say, with analytics. But for me, being a very forward thinking person, I think we can, the results speak for themselves for the past couple of decades, that, you know, like the Yankees now, since sabermetrics were introduced, they've only had one World Series title since the year 2000. So yep, it's
exactly
so the Yankees are no longer the big bully on the block that can't be beat. I mean, there's multiple Davids that have come out and gone up against the Goliaths of the world, and what we've seen with the records of teams like the A's and the Rays, what's come from them. I think you can see since Fox Sports acquired StatSync back in 2001. It's not just Fox, but it's like everybody else. You can the announcers, the different graphics, the things in the game, like they unpack way more of the more complex stats. Be like the scouting report is just a fraction of what is shown in the game compared to more of like the OPS, the ERA, things like that are highlighted much more during a broadcast. It really kind of, the analytics and the strategy that has come from it in the game reminds me a lot of around 20 years ago when the spread offense first really became introduced into football. It really shook up the fundamentals and put a greater focus on making plays at every opportunity. It led to ultimately a game that grew in a ton of popularity and led to teams that were at a historical talent disadvantage to being more successful, that could go up against the Nebraskas, the Texases, the USCs, Michigans of the world. That really kind of started shaking it up. And I mean, I think you see the effect of that in college football today. You know, with how many of those historical blue blood teams are having more just kind of spurts of success and are kind of more along like the 8 or 9 win range compared to ones that they've emerged as kind of like the newer powers in college football at this point now. I think it's great with that.
As Tech fans, you know we're going to bring up the spread offense.
Oh, so, absolutely.
This is not a football podcast by any stretch of the imagination.
But I mean, for me personally, like I think that with our discussions around the game of baseball, I always find things to connect to sports.
Exactly. And I'm glad you brought that up. Another good book, The Perfect Pass, is a good book. This is the third book I'll recommend now. This is on college football. It's about Hal Mumme and how he created the spread offense. And one of his proteges, Mike Leach.
Yep.
different sport, but you get the point. It's teams that are able to gain an edge by any means necessary. And I'm all for stats. I mean, this is technology. This is tech. We're in the informational age. Technology is available. We have supercomputers and ways to view the game. I mean, in the broadcasts, they'll talk about launch angles and exit velocity. And again, one of the frustrations, the most common frustrations of sabermetrics is the shift. the defense shifts because, again, based on the stats that you can very easily gather based on modern technology, you can have a percentage of a player's potential to hit a ball in a certain part of the field. And so then this defense shifts accordingly. And a lot of people hate the shift. They're like, it's a more easy out. And I'm kind of torn on that because, you know, they're trying to get an out. They're not just going to stand in their conventional spot when they know, like Joey Gallo, he's mostly going to pull it to the right.
And Joey Gallo a ton of times is like, screw your shift. I'm just going to hit a bomb. And
exactly. So, and they're talking about banning the shift, and I don't know. I'm kind of torn on that,
I don't see baseball to this point as like the analytics have come to a point of over control of every variable. I think, you know, baseball has all sorts of different parks with different personalities, you still have the AL and NL kind of differences. You've got different climates where different things are, like, you know, I can't remember if it's the humidity kind of with the almost like the evening kind of ocean fog that comes in places like Los Angeles and San Francisco, if that causes, I forget off the top of my head, if it causes more of the ball to carry longer or
maybe the opposite. I know that it carries longer in Denver.
Yeah. I think it's in drier environments, it carries longer, and then like more humid environments, it's different from that. But I think there's enough variables in the game that you can't like absolutely control those or take them out of it. That like, I think it's kind of at this perfect mixture of like progression of analytics, but with still the natural variables that come from the game of baseball.
Yep. And at the end of the day, you know, I'm all for teams doing this, and just, it's a way to elevate the competition. But at the end of the day, it's getting like up to your eyeballs and stats and statistics. But there's always the off chance that no matter how well you evaluate a player, they can buck the trend. Because if a pitcher goes up and 9 times out of 10, he's going to not be worth anything. There's always that one time where he gets a hit and he bucks the trend. And it's the human element. And in Moneyball, what you'll read, and again, I can't recommend that book enough. That is an essential book. Listen to the audiobook. That's how I did it, and I ate it up. One of the points that the author made in that book is like, there's always the human element, and you can get closer to fully being able to predict every little thing that a player can do, but they can always surprise you. And so, yeah, teams, they need to go and they need to get their stats, guys, and they need to figure it out. The Los Angeles Dodgers are able to do great because they have a lot of money and they are clearly implementing, you know, modern technology again. They were the teams that implemented it with Branch Rickey back when they were in Brooklyn, and now here they are in LA continuing Branch Rickey's legacy. So, I mean, the Dodgers are the Dodgers, and the Yankees, I don't know what the heck the Yankees are doing, but I frankly don't care because they have 27 World Series championships. So if they continue to lose for another 10 years, I don't care.
The Yankees are going to be the Yankees like forever because they've, by and large, have run away with those titles over the years.
So this is part of baseball
You can enjoy it. You don't have to focus on stats. You can enjoy it, what it is. But it is an integral part of the game, so it's good to be aware of it. But there's many different ways to view the game of baseball. You can be hyper-focused and be like those volunteers and getting every stat, or you can kick back and enjoy watching the long ball and watching the beautiful game of baseball. There are many different ways to view it and appreciate it as a fan.
Yeah, absolutely. We, being part of this community here, you will, if you continue to join us, you will see, you'll continue to be a part of episodes where we go back and forth between diving in more to the deeper analytical matters of the game, and then just more of like the fun kind of like cultural matters of the game too, and then like a mix of both. So there's so many things that we can unpack with the game of baseball, and this is just, as Barrett mentioned, this is just one kind of scratching of the surface here on analytics. And he's recommended some great literature and media to continue to build your knowledge on it. I know certainly I'll be following up on it and having it on my radar in the future. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, hey, we're kind of out of time for today's episode. This has been a lot of fun. Go on ahead and subscribe to No Doubter Today. Give us a like on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram. You'll see all the important links and information you need to know about No Doubter in the description below. Give us a review to let us know if you enjoyed this show and what you're thinking about it so far and how we can bring you even better content here on No Doubter. And join our Patreon today and get an even greater level of access to this community. We've got great ideas and fun things in the pipeline that will be coming for that soon, and we really want to add some great value. Invite you to be a part of it. So Barrett, close this out, my friend.
And remember, guys, always swing for the fences. Thank y'all very much for joining us. Y'all have a great rest of your day. We'll see you for the next episode.
This episode of No Doubter was produced by Barrett Bostick and Travis Laughlin and edited by Travis Foster. Our logo was designed by Lindsay Soblick.